Good morning and welcome. You are tuned into 2SER 107.3. You are listening to Final Draft. My name is Andrew Popel, and every week it is my absolute pleasure coming in, joining you, sharing books, writing, and literary culture. I love discovering what is new in Australian writing and bringing it to you, talking to the authors so that together we can understand and appreciate more the things that we are reading. Today is no exception, and in fact, I have a fantastic new book for you. I'm also going to be having a little bit of a look at the Sydney Writers Festival program. It dropped just this week, and we've got so much to look forward to come April that I couldn't resist having a sneak peek. Now, on the show today, I am going to be speaking with WA-based Irish author Dervla McTiernan. Dervla has been based in Australia for about the last 10 years. She's originally from County Cork in Ireland, and she has crafted an absolutely fantastic detective crime series around Detective Cormac Riley. The first book was The Ruin, and the second book is The Scholar. Now, The Scholar takes us to Galway on Ireland's western coast, and Cormac Riley is called to the scene of a supposed hit and run by his partner, Dr. Emma Sweeney. The situation soon looks very, very difficult, as an ID card indicates this is none other than a billionaire's daughter who has been hit. And of course, it's never as simple as that. Now, I can't wait to share my conversation with Dervla. It's so much fun talking crime, also so very difficult because, of course, it all hinges on who done it. But before we get to The Scholar, the Sydney Writers Festival dropped their program Thursday evening here in Sydney. And this is, you know, I'm going to use cliches like book Christmas, but it really is such a fantastic time in Sydney when the Writers Festival descends on us. And this is kind of that lead up period where you start to get thinking, what am I going to go see? Who do I want to hear? It is an absolutely amazing international and local contingent that are coming up this year, and I wanted to share just a little bit of it with you. Now, the opening address, which highlights some of the big names that are coming to the festival, the opening address, which will be looking at the festival theme, Lie to Me, is going to be, it's going to feature Nana Kwame Adjei-Brenya. He is the author of Friday Black, which has really been getting so much attention, collection of stories that are really immediate and speaking to his experience as a black man in America. It's also going to feature Max Porter, a British author. I received one of his books the other day, so I'm really looking forward to diving into it. And also New York Times bestselling author Meg Wolitzer. Her books include The Female Persuasion, The Interestings, and The Wife. Now, the opening address will also be accompanied by so many great events. The festival is going to be at its new site for its second year at Carriage Works in Redfern and Everleigh. Now, one of the feature events is Lie to Me, an evening of storytelling at Sydney Town Hall. This is one of the big events as well. It's going to feature Tim Sutpomasan, who is the former Racial Discrimination Commissioner, Scott Ludlam, who was formerly an Australian Greens Senator, Megan Washington, she's a two-time ARIA Award winner, Ayinka Braithwaite, who is she's one of the international authors, Eki Temelkaran. It's Nayuka Gori, who is a fantastic Australian writer and social commentator, Patricia Cornelius, who is an Australian playwright. Benjamin Law is hosting the evening, and Benjamin Law, you've heard him on the show many times before. So this is going to be a fantastic evening around the theme of Lie to Me. I was at the program launch, and Michaela Maguire, who is the festival artistic director, introduced the theme of Lie to Me with an anecdote and sort of a reminisce of the Buffy the Vampire Slayer episode. It was from season 2, where Buffy, needing to be consoled over a particularly harsh loss, asks her friends. She says, "Lie to me." And I'm really interested to see how the festival is going to explore this theme, because it can feel sometimes like we want people to lie to us. We want those beautiful lies that will help us feel better about a world that doesn't seem to offer too much. But then also we have a situation where it feels like we're constantly being lied to. We're being lied to by the people that we're supposed to be able to trust, the people that are supposed to represent us, the people that are supposed to lead us and guide us. what do lies offer us? What does that temptation to have someone lie to us really mean? I'm really looking forward to this. And there are so many other great events. I've just mentioned two. If you go to swf.org.au, you can check out the full festival lineup. You can check out all of the great international and Australian authors and the events that they're going to be appearing at. Tickets have gone on sale. And rest assured that here on Final Draft, we are going to be featuring some festival authors for you. If you go to the Final Draft podcast, I think you'll find that there are already quite a few festival authors up there. We love speaking to Australian authors, and so many of them are available. Behrouz Behchani is going to be appearing at the festival. You can check out the podcast episode where I spoke with him from Manus Island. Graham Simsion, the author of the Rosie novels, is going to be at the festival. Toni Jordan, her latest, The Fragments, is one of the podcasts that is up right now. You can find that on Spotify, on iTunes, wherever you get your podcasts. Now, as I mentioned before, coming up on the show, I am going to be speaking with Deirdre McTiernan, and she's an Irish-Australian author, and her latest is the crime drama thriller, The Scholar. Deirdre is going to be coming up after this short break, so please join me for a fantastic episode of Final Draft.
Explore your artistic talents at NIDA with our winter residency program. For ages 15 plus, NIDA's residencies are designed for committed artists who are ready for intensive training delivered full-time for 2, 3, or 4 weeks. Acting, musical theatre, directing, writing and more. Residencies applications are now open for a July start. Go to nida.edu.au/residency. NIDA sponsors 2SER 107.3.
You are tuned into 2SER 107.3. This is Final Draft, and I am Andrew Popel. And I'm joined on the line by Deirdre McTiernan. Deirdre is a lawyer turned crime writer. She's originally from County Cork in Ireland, and now she calls Western Australia home. The Scholar is Deirdre's second outing for Detective Cormac Riley following 2018's The Ruin. So, Deirdre, welcome to Final Draft.
Thank you very much for having me. Very happy to be here.
I'm excited. I want to tell people a little bit about The Scholar, and I'm going to acknowledge before we even start that any mystery needs a spoiler. And in a mystery like this, that sort of twists and turns, has I really, without giving spoilers, I feel comfortable talking about the first two paragraphs of the first page without giving anything.
Yeah, it's a really hard one to talk about. Really hard. Without giving everything away, you kind of have to skip your way through the novel.
I started writing questions and realized even just the nature of the question would give something away. So I just took the people's names out of it.
Yeah.
I'm going to introduce the scholar. So there's been a hit and run outside Galway University and a young woman is dead. Cormac Riley's partner, Dr. Emma Sweeney, discovers the body. But calling Cormac first leads to a world of trouble as the investigation is threatened by their personal involvement. When an ID card on the body shows the victim to be a billionaire heiress, it's quickly apparent this is more than a simple accidental death. There is so much obfuscation in just that description there, but let's get down to brass tacks. Say I'm a criminal. I'm not. Mm-hmm. But say I'm a criminal. What do I need to know about Detective Cormac Riley before I consider committing a crime in Galway?
Just don't do it. Don't do it. He's smart, and he's, you know, the word that's leaping to mind, which sounds terribly boring, is dogged, you know? Mm. And he's not dull, but he is professional and clever and experienced. So he doesn't get distracted by, you know, rubbish. He doesn't get distracted by inter-office politics and that sort of thing. He has something in front of him, and he's going to keep going until he gets to the end. That is just the way he's always worked.
It struck me as I read that Cormac's, he's a bit of a white hat without being a white hat. There are a couple of really little subtle nods to the fact that he's actually quite a handsome man. He's quite tall, that he's got a presence about him. He seems kind of incorruptible. There is something of the square-jawed hero about him.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Yet it's never bashed over your head, so it really doesn't jump out at you. It's just a presence.
Well, I'm glad it's not bashed over your head, but I definitely set out with that in mind. You know, Cormac's had it really easy, and he doesn't know it. Hmm. You know, he is good-looking. He was good at sport in school. You know, he's he was easily and well-liked, and then he went and he chose a profession that really suits him. You know, being a policeman is absolutely the right job for him. It suits his skills, he's good at it, and he's done well. But life, all the cards have kind of gone his way up until I got involved in his life, and then suddenly things are going to get a lot more complicated. You know, he will not be presented with simple black and white answers where he can just do a great job and go home and pat himself on the back. You know, he is going to be forced into a series of situations where he has to choose a compromise where there is no good answer. And I'm really interested to see what happens when you put a genuinely decent person in those circumstances and they are forced to make those compromise decisions. How do they then move forward when they have a new vision of themselves as a result? You know, how do they find a way to look at themselves and make peace with their decisions and still be that good person going forward? Mm-hmm. So in The Ruin, I kind of feel like I put him in that position. And then in The Scholar, it's that bit more personal. So that's why, for me, it's interesting that Cormac is a decent guy, because I want to see what happens to decent people in really difficult circumstances.
Yeah, well, the hit and run presents Cormac with a conflict. He wants to protect his partner, Emma. And I keep saying partner, but not in the sense of a police officer. This is his romantic partner. But he also wants to maintain that meticulous observation of procedure, the collection of evidence. I really noticed that thread throughout the book, which is fascinating, the way that so much can hinge not on right and wrong, but on whether it was properly documented and bagged.
Yeah.
But what I'm most interested here for Cormac is how procedure balances against humanity in these circumstances.
Mm. Mm. Yeah, that's an interesting one. I haven't thought about it quite like that, and yet that is probably the core of it, you know. At the end of the day, everything comes down to relationships and how you work with people. I mean, in every job in the world, whether you're a policeman or whatever you're doing, we all know sometimes relationships can make things run very smoothly or can make things extraordinarily difficult. Mm. And one of the things I'm interested in the Scholar is sort of that fundamental truth is very easily corrupted. You know, when we rely on relationships and we rely on favors and we rely on the person we want to phone picking up the phone for, you know, phone to a phone call from us and then doing the thing we want them to do, that's necessary for good work, but it's also the thing that can lead down a very dark path. So for me, it's kind of interesting to see show Cormac in a way using those relationships and using that interaction in a positive way, but also showing the flip side of it.
Now, within the narrative of The Scholar, you switch between points of view of characters, and even then within chapters. So the chapters are actually organised by days of the investigation, which is actually a really fantastic way of driving something like this forward. Now, the effect of this switch of point of view, I found, is to both raise and extinguish the reader's attempts at speculation. We travel from police officers to potential suspects to witnesses. It also weaves a tighter web, though, around the mystery. We hear our suspects absolve themselves. I came up with theories, and then on the next page, you would actually just take me to the person who had a theory about, and they'd be like, oh, well, I know I didn't do it, because here I am inside my own head thinking about how I didn't do it. Why did you land on this particular shifting of perspective to build your narrative?
Wow, Andrew, I wish it was that deliberate. You sound much more intelligent than I am.
Well, many narratives will stick with the heroic protagonist's point of view, and you will get the clues as they get them. But here, you really muck around with our heads in that way.
Yeah, you know, I think I find I like to get close to the crime with the people who are directly impacted by it, because I want that emotional resonance. I think, there's this thing I have written, hand scribbled on a piece of paper and stuck to my notice board in my study, and I got it, I'd love to say, from the original Aristotle, but I think I got it from a TED talk. But anyway, it says the basis of story is these three words, pity, fear, catharsis. That's what it is. So pity for me means empathy. I want you to feel something for my characters. And for me, the most important people to feel for are the people who are impacted by the crime. If I can get you to feel something for the characters, then it's easier to have you fear for them. And at that point, you're involved. You know, you're caught up in the story, and then I can resolve it, and it can be satisfying for a reader. So I need to get up close. If I just stay in the detective's head all the way through, then it's an interesting intellectual puzzle. And to the degree I can make it about his personal life and I can show elements of his personal life, well, you can be to some degree engaged. Mm. And those books can be very satisfying in their own way. But I love the books where I am feeling everything on the page, and the characters are people I know. You know, by the time I'm halfway through, I feel like I know them. And that's what I'm trying for. So to get you there, I need to show you points of view for people who are closer to the crime.
You are tuned in to 2SER 107.3. You're listening to Final Draft, and my name is Andrew Popel. I am speaking with Devla McTin, and that is Devla. We are discussing her latest, The Scholar, and we're going to be back with more of that conversation, looking into crime fiction and the ramifications of international events on Ireland and how they inform something like The Mystery and The Scholar. But right now, we're going to take a track. This is from Melbourne band The Money War, and the track is Hey Now. Let's get out of here. You are tuned into 2SER 107.3. This is Final Draft, books, writing and literary culture every Saturday morning. Just there, we heard a track from The Money War. That was Hey Now. And I am back speaking with Devla McTin. And Devla is originally from County Cork in Ireland. She is based in WA, where she has written two absolutely fantastic thrillers featuring her detective Cormac Riley. We are discussing The Scholar, set in Galway. Cormac Riley's been called to the scene of a presumably hit-and-run accident, but when an identity card is found on the victim and reveals she is a billionaire's granddaughter, we know the plot is going to thicken. Now, I find that any crime, you know, it has its consequences, but it also can pay to look at the antecedents. It occurs as we're talking, I'm thinking more and more about the way you have crafted the relationships between characters, names redacted. It's so hard not to spoil anything in this. But there is a huge tragedy in choices that were made before the narrative of the scholar begins that implicate people in behaviours that they probably wouldn't have taken otherwise except out of desperation. And that leads to no satisfactory conclusion because the dead are still dead and in a way their memory has been tarnished.
Yes. Oh, what was that? Yes. I mean, I think sometimes there is just no happy, perfect answer, you know, no wrapped up in a bow. And sometimes we have to confront the result of what we've done before we can move forward and do better, you know. And sometimes the best people are the ones who are hurt. And occasionally narratives can be too tidy and that it's like, oh, well, you know, the worst things happen to the bad people and the good people ultimately get to walk away. But that's not real life, unfortunately. We all know that. Sometimes the worst things happen to good people. So maybe that's why that is the way it is in the book. Although I don't mean to make it sound all sadness because it isn't really. But I don't know. I just, maybe it is scratching the scab off it, but I feel that we need to pull back the veil a little bit sometimes too and see the reality of what we're living in. And, you know, I think that can be satisfying too for us when we read because we know what the reality is because we're all living it.
Yeah.
And sometimes it feels like we're not talking about, like the conversation never comes around to what we're really all dealing with. And it's nice, sometimes it's satisfying to get into that and see it addressed maybe.
I think you may have just answered my next question as well. I thought just to, because I can't go too much into the plot of the scholar and of everything that we've said, there is still an absolute ripper mystery that you can really get into as you turn each page of the names redacted characters that we can't tell you too much about. So alone, that is a reason to read this. But I was intrigued in the last couple of days. An article that sort of brought together some recent research, including an Australia Council 2016 report that was entitled Reading the Reader. And one thing that report found was that crime and mystery sort of thriller, that was the most popular category for readers. So you're a reader, you're a fan. We talked off air about your Adrian McGinty reference that you've dropped into the book. You obviously love the genre. You're also a writer of the genre. Do you have any insight into what we get from these books, what we're searching for? And we've just gone into great length about that sort of catharsis and reflection.
Well, I have two answers to this question. The first one I steal happily from Sophie Hannah, who wrote an article about it in The Guardian some time ago, around the time, I think it was the London Book Fair, something was on and it had been announced that crime had overtaken general fiction, if there's such a category, for the first time in popularity. It was bigger in itself than all the others put together. And she said that she thinks it's because the reader can be confident that the writer would put the reader's enjoyment ahead of whatever the writer might be getting out of the process. Like there will be a plot, you know, there will be excitement, there will be characters that you're interested in, it will move forward. So I think there might be a little bit of truth to that. But I think the other one comes out of when I was in the UK last year for Harrogate, I was staying in London and I got to go to the Old Bailey and observe a high court criminal case and have lunch with the judges, which was a very interesting experience. But the sheriff of the high court in the Old Bailey was there and he was telling us stories about the origin of the Old Bailey in the very old days in the early 1800s and back when they were still hanging people there. And he said that the jailers used to sell little short stories, sort of tales of the people who had been hung, you know, how they went to their deaths and the crimes that they had committed. And these things were incredibly lurid and detailed and exaggerated and sometimes just completely made up. And apparently all of these tales were bound together and put in a book, which was published and sold and was second only to the Bible in popularity in Britain back in those days. So I think crime fiction in some form or another has been popular as long as it has existed. And some part of us is just attracted to these extremes, you know, these extreme elements of our society, I guess.
Wow. That's a fascinating story too. Why is everything always second only to the Bible in sales?
I don't know. Why couldn't it have come in first just for one?
I mean, notoriously, that book is lacking a good mystery.
exactly.
You are tuned into 2SER 107.3, and I am speaking with Dervla McTiernan. We are discussing her latest Cormac Riley mystery, The Scholar. I haven't been able to tell you much, dear listener, about this because there are so many twists. I didn't want to take anything away. Trust me, though, get out and get into the mystery and perhaps some of the tragedy that we've just been speaking about. Dervla, thank you so much for taking the time out to share this and share Cormac with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Andrew. It's been a real pleasure to speak with you.
Hi, I'm Anna Clark, host of Glam City. In our new season, we'll explore the depths of some of Australia's lesser-known archives and museum collections.
I always say that everything in my office is heritage-listed, essentially. Like, be careful with the toaster.
We'll speak with historians about the deep time history written on Australia's landscape.
You know, learning language is such a general option. We're talking country.
Glam City, your backstage pass into Australia's galleries, libraries, archives and museums. Catch the new season on Monday nights at 7 or wherever you get your podcasts.
You are tuned in to 2SER 107.3. It's about 10:25 this Saturday morning. You are tuned in to Final Draft, and my name is Andrew Popel. Now, there's not much time left on the show, so I want to send out a thank you to Dervla McTiernan for coming into the show and talking about her latest, The Scholar. Now, Sydney Writers Festival has also dropped, and you can go out and check out the program. Start planning now. I know I already am. Now, I want to preview because next week I'm going to be joined by Peggy Frew. She is a much-celebrated author of House of Sticks and Hope Farm, and she has a new novel out called Islands. Peggy is also going to be on the Sydney Writers Festival lineup, so we are going to start giving you some previews as well as exploring Islands. Now, if you want to get more of Final Draft, if you want to hear more from Dervla McTiernan, if you want to discover some of the great authors that are going to be at Sydney Writers Festival, go no further than the Great Conversations podcast. It's available on Spotify, it's available on iTunes, it's available wherever you get your podcasts. You can subscribe via the RSS on Pocket Casts and all of the many great platforms. And it is a great way to get new books, new Final Draft every week, delivered straight to your phone. If you're enjoying the show, if you're just going, I need more, give us a rating. Recommend it to friends, suggest it, share it widely so that we know the love out there and to keep doing what we're doing. Now, I'm going to leave you with a track. Don't go anywhere, though. The Vulture's Nest is coming up, and they are just a fantastic, absolutely essential perspective on the weekend news. But this is from a Brisbane soul artist, Tiana Kasi. The track is called They Call Me. My name is Andrew Popel, and till next week for Final Draft, happy reading. Bye now.
They call me Eve, they call me Mother, these are my names. Sisters and brothers, daughter of Frida. They call me Aisha, birth to believers. They call me. They call me. They call me Eve, they call me Mother. Took the bite to some by my father. People's history, it starts with my name, blissfully blaming me, but I feel no shame. I feel no shame when they call me. They call me. The chosen trouble cast me out as Magdalene. Emancipate myself from names I call myself immaculate. Did you forget for your soul and burnt your flesh to action name? Fit the mother tongue I woke for you, split in two hits. They call me Eve, they call me Mother, these are my names. Sisters and brothers, daughter of Frida. They call me Aisha, birth to believers. Thank you.